I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dr. Holly Johnson. Her career in the field of violence against women began as a government researcher and evolved into criminology professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada. Her primary research interests focused on criminal justice and social responses to sexual violence, intimate partner violence, and partner homicide, and on the methodological challenges to measuring the nature and prevalence of these experiences. While in the federal government, she was a principal investigator of Statistics Canada's first national survey on violence against women and a coordinator of the International Violence Against Women Survey. Dr. Johnson was also involved in many other national and international networks aimed at refining research tools, preventing violence against women, and improving interventions and responses to these crimes. At the international level, Dr. Johnson served as an expert advisor to several UN groups working to develop accurate indicators on violence against women. In her local community, Dr. Johnson held membership in the Ottawa Coalition to End Violence Against Women, worked with the Ottawa Police Service to improve their response to crimes of violence against women, and worked with the University of Ottawa to address sexual violence on campus. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being in the program.
It's an absolute pleasure of mine.
So Peggy Reeve-Sandé discussed rape in across cultures and how there are markers of high rape cultures. And one of the markers is that there's a greater status difference, that men have far greater status than women. And so when I was reading about that and studying it, I started looking up rates of rape across culture, or across countries. And the reported rates of rape don't seem to make any sense to me, that Sweden, relatively egalitarian, it seems, Sweden would have the sixth highest rate in the world. The second lowest rate would be Egypt with 0.1 rapes per 100,000 people, even though 87% of women and girls in Egypt have undergone female genital mutilation. It's not making any sense. Mozambique is the second lowest. They have 1/250th of the rate in the United States. So the statistics seem frankly random. And so can you help me understand the relationship between actual rates of rape and these reported rates? What are the methodological problems here?
Well, first of all, it's critical to understand the source of the data that you're looking at. And I think you're looking at police statistics. Now, police statistics undergo, before they get to the final statistic, undergo what we call this funnel of attrition. So what we know from other sources, which I can elaborate on later on, is that very, very, very few women report sexual violence to the police for all kinds of good reasons related to family pressures, not to related to blaming themselves, worried about being blamed by the police, worrying about how they'll be treated by the police, shame and embarrassment and all kinds of reasons. In Canada, that figure is 95% of women don't report to the police.
You say 95%?
Don't report. So only 5%. And that varies. The latest statistic was 5%. Sometimes it's 8%, but it's always under 10%. And that we know that from going directly to random samples of women to talk about their experiences. And so very, very few report. And that's uniform across the world. The statistics may vary, but it's a very small percentage. And when they report to the police, depending on, you know, the individual police officer who responds, they may or may not take it seriously, depending on how the woman's dressed, how what she's been doing, whether she's been drinking, whether she's reported sexual violence to them in the past. They operate still, and we've been talking about this for 30 or 40 years, they operate on stereotypes of who's a legitimate victim. And so, and who's deserving of the protection of the criminal justice system. So we will call these reported rapes, but really they're recorded. And so the police will use their discretion to code some as unfounded, to say that they didn't happen, to dismiss them out of hand, or sometimes record them and don't follow up. But so in Canada, of the unfounding has been a very, very big focus of public policy change, very, very slowly. But there was a big study done by a reporter at our national newspaper, the Globe and Mail, who got data from police departments across the country and did a big expose for about a year, keeping it on the front page about the very high rates of unfounded across the country. And it ranged from, you know, 2 or 4% to 51% in one jurisdiction. And so police have enormous discretion to decide what's going to go forward and what's going to be recorded as a crime. And then only about half of those at the national level that they record as founded go on to gather evidence for a prosecution. So, you know, the police are gathering data in a social context, and the context around the world vary tremendously. And I would expect Sweden has a pretty sophisticated data collection regime, where I don't know what the unfounding rates are there. I don't know what the biases are. I haven't studied Sweden. But I would assume that Egypt, I might be wrong, but might have a less good regime in terms of collecting statistics on sexual assaults that are reported to the police. I also suspect that some countries will vary tremendously in the willingness of women to come forward, because it's just not done. It's she won't get support from anyone in her family. She will be ostracized. She might be blamed for it. And so you're dealing with cultural context, and you're dealing with sophistication of data gathering regimes, and you're dealing with police discretion on a very broad scale. So that is to say that they're very, very unreliable source of information about rape.
So I just, for the record, I didn't know anything about this 3 weeks ago, but Sweden, a difference between Sweden and other Northern European countries is that Swedish police are required to at least record, I don't know whether they have to investigate, but they're at least required to record every rape that is reported to them.
And police in other countries might have the same directives, but don't actually do it. So if Sweden is right up there, they may actually be following that directive. In Canada, after this big investigation by the national newspaper into unfounding, and it galvanized, it put a lot of pressure on police, both at the local level and also Statistics Canada, who determines how police are going to record data and submit it to them so that we have national police statistics and compare across jurisdictions. And Statistics Canada was pressured to change the way they, because the police said, well, you know, there aren't enough categories there. So if she decides she doesn't want to go forward, we put it in unfounding because we have nowhere else to put it. So, okay, Statistics Canada improved that. And the directive to the police was, you will record everything as legitimate unless there you have solid evidence that a crime did not occur. So the directive to the police now is, you will report, which sounds like similar to the Swedish situation. Whether or not they do it, they still will always have discretion. But there will be many countries where police don't have that directive, that there's much more free-flowing discretion, and then all kinds of biases come into play about who's a legitimate victim.
So before we go on, is this same process, or are the numbers even remotely the same for, I don't know, burglary, armed robbery? Is this just a generic crime reporting problem, or is this specific to, at least somewhat specific to, violence against women?
Yeah, I think it's specific to sexual violence, sexual harassment, or criminal harassment, or stalking, domestic violence. There's all kinds of biases built in there, based on, you know, men entitlement over women's bodies, men entitled to control their partners, and that sort of thing, which doesn't apply, obviously, to property crimes. So they are unique in that sense. And, you know, police do have discretion not to follow up on a burglary if it's, you know, a juvenile, and they can divert them into something else, go easy on them, sort of. But the same kind of biases don't apply.
And at the very least, it's probably going to be recorded.
Yes, far more likely to be reported. But I would say that the only reliable statistic in police data is homicide. because they're almost always reported. They're almost always recorded accurately. And, you know, some may be recorded erroneously as a suicide or an accident or a missing person or something, but they're almost always recorded accurately and followed up on. So anything else, there's a lot of discretion about whether even to report to the police, because it's a big hassle to report to police. And if you, you know, someone stole your bike and you don't have insurance, what are they going to do, right? So there's a lot of unreported crime. Sexual assault is, in our jurisdictions anyway, the highest.
So maybe this is too soon for this question, but if police reports or recorded rapes are a not accurate source of information, what is a source of information? If somebody really wanted to know the relative rates of rape in Egypt versus Iceland, where would you go?
Well, that's kind of a long story, but I think it's useful if I start at the beginning. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, there was a lot of frustration among rape crisis shelters and domestic violence centers on the very, very low rates of sexual assault that are coming out of police statistics, but also this thing called crime victimization surveys. So those started to provide so national statistical agencies conduct in the US, the UK, Canada, other places, to ask random samples of the population about crime. And police were initially really resistant toward this idea because they said, you don't want to know about crime, you just come to us. But, you know, sociologists and, you know, our own personal experience got us thinking that, well, not all crimes are reported. And so we also want to know about people's perceptions of crime, perceptions of their safety, perceptions of the police. So they started a methodology where random samples of the population would be interviewed by telephone about those things. And they would start out saying, you know, I want to think about crime in your neighborhood and how safe do you feel? And how do you feel about the police and all kinds of, not those questions, of course, but very detailed. And they ran very frequently in Canada and the US and Great Britain. And so we had trends over time. At the same time, there were two very, very influential researchers in the United States, one Diana Russell and one named Mary Koss, who started doing very dedicated surveys on violence against women. Diana Russell was in San Francisco, Mary Koss was in colleges in a number of different locations, and they brought in specialized methodologies. So specially hired interviewers, special question wording that was very sensitive and very detailed, trained their interviewers, and they came out with rates that were many times higher than the crime victimization survey. So the crime victimization surveys were considered to be a vast improvement over the police because, lo and behold, look at how many unreported sexual assaults we have. But another thing about the victimization surveys was the results they produced showed that rape and domestic violence are low. Women have a high level of fear, which is more an emotional reaction about how terrible it would be to be raped, but in reality, it was very unlikely, and a high level of protecting themselves. And so the public policy issue became reducing fear among women, not reducing violence. Because look, this new wonderful methodology is showing us it really is pretty rare. And it went unquestioned for a long time because it really fit into the public understanding of rape being a rare thing. Oh, and women also reported more likely to report to these victimization surveys that they were assaulted by strangers and that they reported to the police. High rates of reporting. So in other words, they were reporting to survey interviewers what they had already come public with through a report to the police. So, Mary Koss and Diana Russell got busy and developed this, you know, pretty much a feminist-informed way of interviewing women. They interviewed random samples of women, and the rates they came out with were 7 and 10 times higher than what was produced by the National Crime Victimization Survey in the United States. And so that was kind of the beginning of feminist informed using the standard methodology of a crime victimization survey. So here in Canada, we really learned from that. We went one step. So we had this horrible event in 1989 where 14 women were murdered at a university in Montreal, the Montreal Massacre. And big focus then on violence against women, a lot of resources being dedicated to it. And I was at Statistics Canada, and we were asked by another department, you know, how can we improve our measurement of violence against women? And we said, well, we should conduct a dedicated survey on violence against women, which we did. And, you know, developed carefully with careful question wording and recruited interviewers and no male interviewers and trained them and came out with pretty shocking numbers. But we worked with the police to make sure that the questions we asked would be consistent with a criminal code offense so that we had that legitimacy. We'd be able to stand back and say, oh, no, these are all crimes. Even though we also measured sexual harassment and things were not crimes. So, you know, that was kind of the beginning. And then it got, that methodology got picked up. National Crime Survey did some, some adjustments to improve what they were doing. But then there were other big surveys in the United States and around the world. So that's when I got involved in, you know, UN work. And so to answer your question, I don't know if there's a survey that compares Iceland and the other country you mentioned, but there are a number now of international surveys. There's one on 27 or so EU countries. There was the International Violence Against Women Survey. I was involved with 10 or 11 countries. Another one the WHO did. And these researchers will look to other similar surveys for question wording and so forth, so that they are comparable. Now, these surveys aren't perfect. They totally rely on candid and honest responses, which not every woman's willing to do, especially if she's living in a violent relationship. But they really are much more reliable than police statistics. And the UN has produced a manual on how to do these and really pushing. If you want reliable numbers that are going to inform policy development, then this is the way to go. And this is where we know that 95% are not reported. So you have to, random samples mean you can generalize to the population. So that was a long-winded answer to your question.
No, that's great. That's really helpful. So can you give an example of, I make up an example of a question or how questions would elicit a response that is 1/7 to 1/10 the actual, what would be a difference between a question where a woman who had been sexually assaulted would say, no, I haven't, versus one where she might disclose.
In the beginning, they really believed that the state had no business asking really sensitive questions. So they really skirted around it. And so it was kind of doomed to fail. A question like, so a two-part question. First, a screener. Have you ever been attacked? So somebody's supposed to understand that that includes rape. So it's not until the next, this was the original, in the original U.S. National Crime Survey. And then once they're screened in, they would be asked more specific questions about sexual assault and molesting. But they were not detailed enough for people to understand, was my experience fit into that? And they don't know what question's coming next. So they kind of are, because it's over the phone, they're not looking at these questions. So they're really kind of, well, I don't know if my experience should be included in that. We had their first national survey on violence against women in Canada. The question, has anybody ever forced you into any sexual activity, such as holding you down, assaulting you, this sort of thing? And then there's a supplemental question about unwanted sexual touching. We don't have a crime and rape of rape in Canada anymore. It's sexual assault. And now there's been added a question about being unable to consent because of drugs or alcohol. So, with, you know, the definition of sexual assault is broadening. And so these surveys have to try to keep up with them. But just asking somebody if you've even been assaulted, and if a woman's in a domestic situation, she doesn't know whether to call that assault or not. So assault is assault, something that men do in bars, you know? So the question wording needs to be specific, and there needs to be multiple, what we call behaviorally specific questions to get at it.
And I can see, especially for those raised, I can see, you know, there's the old cliche about a fish not being able to really see water. And especially if you're in a culture where it's pervasive, and I'm thinking not simply a larger culture, but also a domestic violence situation, I can see how one would simply consider this normal as opposed to something that is even remarkable.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's why you have to be really specific on these questions. And I think, you know, your work around rape culture, I think, you know, I was just reading some research today. You probably know it because you're writing a book. It wasn't that long ago where a bunch of college students, male college students in the U.S. were asked if they would force a woman into sex if they thought they could get away with it. And 37% said yes. And then later on, they were asked, would you rape a woman if you thought you could get away with it? And the figure is only about 13%. So they don't equate forced sex with rape. Forced sex is just something you do if you can get away with it, but I wouldn't rape a woman. So if you're immersed in this context where it's normative, then, you know, perpetrators don't, well, they make excuses for not, for doing what they do. But I think you're right. I think it's you have to be mindful of that when you're developing survey questionnaires, that, you know, it has to be specific behaviors without labeling it as rape or something like that. Because, you know, no, I wasn't raped. That wasn't rape. That was my boyfriend.
So how do we, this again might be too soon for this, but how do we, one of the reasons that I want to write about this particular question of men's greater, having far greater status than women leading to higher rape, is that that, as opposed to some of the other markers for high rape cultures, is something that it seems to me that you could make incremental change on. One of the markers is a male creator deity versus a female creator deity or a couple. And that's really a long-term project to change. But we know, for example, that teaching little girls to read gives them enough... those little girls who have been taught to read often do not have quite so many children. It's a very good form of non-draconian birth control, that giving them that amount of control over their lives often leads to control in other parts of their lives. We know that that incremental change of teaching a little girl to read can make dramatic changes in her life later. We know that generically. But is it true, not across all cultures, like Peggy Reeve Sande with Anthropological was studying hunter-gatherers and various widely disparate cultures, is it still true, as it would seem to be, that there are probably higher rates of rape in countries where women are more firmly held down than in countries where women have at least some measure of some measure of equality? I'm asking this very poorly, but do you see what I'm trying to get at? Mm-hmm. And do we have numbers on that? Is that something that has been studied extensively?
Well, you can take these international surveys and do some comparisons. And generally speaking, that's the case. It's what you'd expect. There have also been these kinds of surveys that have been done with men, which I find fascinating, because which proves that if you do it right, men will disclose. Maybe it's because they don't think they're doing anything wrong. I don't know. But there are many countries, developing countries, where this has been done on a multi-country basis. And they interview women to ask for their, like another, to validate the men's, what the men are saying. And in fact, they're saying, yeah. So men actually will report. And it's very much tied to masculinity. It's tied to their attitudes towards women, to attitudes towards women's roles, their own sense of male entitlement. And so we do have some solid evidence at the individual level. And then when you compare countries, it's not always a strong correlation, because, you know, you've still got to rely on the appropriateness of the questions, the willingness of women to come forward. And in developing countries, the interviews are done face to face. So interviewers and survey managers have to be very, very careful about safety. How are you going to ensure this woman's safety? How are you going to, because everybody in the village will know she's being interviewed. And so a great deal of effort goes into thinking about that. I mean, we thought about that when we were interviewing women over the phone. Face to face is a whole other challenge. So, you know, you always have to think, well, in some cultures, maybe women are just really going to underreport it to a survey interviewer because they fear the consequences from partners. So, you know, I just bring it back to there are some limitations and some validity questions about these surveys, even though we know they're the best we have at the moment. But we do have some validation when you put in other questions about women's rightful roles in the home and men's entitlement and so forth. There is a correlation. But I'd also just like to say, I mean, we do, you know, in Canada, the United States, we have this whole discourse of gender equality. You know, oh, we're all equal now. And yeah, we have racial inequalities, but we really have equality between men and women. And I think the more we do that, there's a resistance to acknowledging the pervasiveness of rape culture. The claims about rape culture really lose their legitimacy in cultures that are supposedly gender equal. And violence is one resource available to affirm normative expectations about gender and masculinity. And in context, even when we have discourses about gender equality, meanings of masculinity are unstable and shifting. And I think masculinity requires frequent affirmation through gender performances in these contexts. And sexual violence is a way to demonstrate masculinity to peers. So even though we may have, you know, all the markers of gender equality in a country, masculinity can still be a fragile, unstable thing that requires constant affirmation and degradation of women through sexual harassment, which is something that creates and evolves from rape culture. That happens. You know, I need to reaffirm my masculinity desperately. And so it's one way to do it.
Well, thank you for saying all that, because that brings up three things that I was going to mention. One of them is that while things may be relatively more egalitarian in these countries, there are still obviously ways in which men's status is greater. And a couple of things I want to mention. One is, a few years ago, I had dinner with a very famous woman who is an award-winning actress who we quickly were talking about pornography and how much she hates it. And even though she is on, I found it very interesting that even though she is on lists of, you know, 50 most beautiful women in the world, she said that she had broken up with multiple men because they would refuse to stop looking at pornography when they were with her. And some of them were even enacting the porn scenes on her without her consent at all. And my point in bringing all that up is that this greater status of women in general also does not specifically apply. I mean, this woman has more status than almost anyone in the country or anyone in the world. She has higher status than most men in some ways, yet still men felt it was, they still had sexualized violence against her. So no matter what we say culturally, on a personal level, of course, it doesn't insulate a woman from sexualized violence.
Right. And I think young men and boys are viewing pornography at younger and younger ages, which then establishes this understanding of sexuality for them that is quite toxic. And they don't know any other way to perform.
So thank you for that. And that was one of the things I wanted to bring up. Another thing I wanted to bring up is there, I know that these surveys are so complex and the whole question is so complex, so we might not be able to get this fine of a measurement, but isn't there also, often when a sense of entitlement is threatened, that can often lead to a backlash of increased violence. So after the American Civil War, after the abolition of chattel slavery, the number of lynchings actually went up. And so is there also a certain time for a generation or two, perhaps, where increased status of women could in fact lead to a backlash of increased violence against women because the men are attempting to maintain their control threatened. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, yes, I do. Yeah, I mean, that has been the sort of flip of the Peggy Sandy theory that you mentioned at the outset, that, you know, higher status for women is going to lead to lower rape. Well, the flip side of that is higher status of women leads to resentment and looking for ways to put women in their place and reassert masculinity over them. So I think that's there. Yeah, I think it's, it's one way to demonstrate male dominance and to belittle women. It's, sexual harassment. It's humiliating and it's effective.
So, excuse me, another line that keeps coming to me through all this is there are differences in cultures between, I don't know, I'm just picking random countries, Japan, Iceland, Iran, Mozambique. But I also keep thinking about a line by Mary Daly that there's one religion in the world right now and it's patriarchy, and how these differences in status, I don't mean to be sort of nihilistic and say we shouldn't make changes in the different and the status differential. But I also think it's important to recognize that they're all within the context of this larger, at this point, globalized culture where men have greater status than women. Is this making sense too?
And yeah, absolutely. And that's what feminists have been fighting for now for eons, to recognize the patriarchal power that men continue to have. And again, if we have these claims and discourse around gender equality, it's really hard to talk about that because we're all equal. And I always say, if you think we're equal, you go sit in a sexual assault trial. See how women are treated.
Do you want to go a little bit further with that?
Just that I guess my point is how difficult it is to talk honestly about rape culture. And about, it really sometimes takes an explosive event. And we had one of those in the first week of the academic year, one of our universities in Canada, where 30 women came forward, said that they were drugged and sexually assaulted, 30 women in a residence, which made their living place unsafe. And it's, the president, I guess you measured the progress in different ways. The president of the university, of course, said, we've got a problem here. 9,000 students protested. So, there's progress, but I worked on a task force at the University of Ottawa a few years ago, which was struck by the president on account of two incidents. One involved the hockey team at an away game charged with sexual assault. And the other was really inappropriate sexualized attacks on the president of the students union, who of course was female. And we struck this, and many other universities across the country were doing similar things triggered by similar events. And, you know, now there's training and there's all kinds of policies and there's all these sorts of things happening on campus. But what was obvious to me by this event or this week was that, because they're all saying, you know, our university is enmeshed in rape culture. And I thought, well, that rape culture it came from high school. These guys are, you know, week one in university and they feel entitled. You know, now we've shed off the shackles of home and here we are in residence and we are entitled to have a good time. But that didn't start that day. That started in high school and earlier. So, you know, it's, I think, you know, on one hand, you see progress when we're able to actually acknowledge and talk about it and you know, get action. But without a big event, a catastrophic event like that, sometimes it's very hard to acknowledge and to talk about rape culture and patriarchy.
I'm thinking about the thing you said about how, you know, that people should sit in on a rape trial and or sexual assault trial. And I'm thinking about when my mom's home was burgled, I don't know, 15 years ago. And when the cops showed up, they were just starting to walk around. And one of them looked at the door into the garage and said, "Was that door locked?" And I looked at it and it wasn't locked. And I'm like, "Oh, crap." And I said, "Nah, it wasn't locked." And he said, "It doesn't matter. I mean, it's still burglary." And, and you see what I'm getting at with this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So go ahead and make my point.
Yeah, I mean, the sexual assault would be treated much differently, right? What were you doing there? Why did you do this? What were you wearing?
Yeah, and in this case, it was literally one question. Yeah, and it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter, yeah. Yeah, it's there's a very big difference. I mean, there's a researcher in the UK named Liz Kelly who's been working in this area for years and years. And she describes police culture around sexual violence as a culture of skepticism, where they see their job as finding evidence of consent, which is the usual, almost, you know, if it's kind of a peer group rape or anything other than a stranger, really, the defense is consent. She consented. And then the defense counsel does everything in their power to show that she consented and she's just, you know, a woman wronged or somebody who regrets what she did the night before. And, you know, look at her, of course, she did all of these things. Therefore, that implies consent. You know, she was intoxicated. She took a ride with him, you know, all those things. And so, yeah, they kind of, and I think that does happen. The police are looking for ways to discredit her story right off the bat, as opposed to, oh, well, it doesn't matter. It was still burglary. Very, very different.
So we have about 10 minutes left. And so far, this is so helpful to me. Thank you so much. And before we start to wind down, are there some things you really want to talk about having to do with this generalized subject for which I haven't asked you the right questions? Are there some issues that I'm leaving untouched that really need to be explored?
I don't know, Derek. I mean, I think you're grounding this in rape culture is really important because it does. I mean, I think one of the questions you sent me in advance was, you know, what are the methodological challenges? Is it only methodology or is it that thing that increases the likelihood of sexual violence happening in the first place? And I would say absolutely it's the latter. You know, we can tweak the methodology all we want, but if women are still afraid to come forward to the police and the police still react negatively in a hostile manner to them, if they still miscode them as unfounded and they still do all these things, that's a rape culture problem more than, you know, the adjustments that we're making in Canada to try to encourage police to record these more accurately, and so we reduce the percentage that are unfounded. And, you know, we've had a year of data now, and yes, it dropped a few percentage points, and police are just getting started, so we can expect that to go down. So my question is, how are they coding them? How are they dealing with them now? If there's no material change to the way women are being treated by the criminal justice system, then what does coding matter? It doesn't matter a bit to her, to the women who are actually having to deal with it, of the impacts of that. So it's a start, and statistics are, you know, I've spent my life trying to improve statistics. I think they're vitally important, but we have to really keep our eyes on it to ensure that it's not just a coding and just say, oh, well, the problem's fixed now. But we really haven't made any changes. And the interesting thing, you probably know about the investigation that went on in Philadelphia about 20 years ago, where a journalist discovered that there were well over half of sexual assaults in Philadelphia were being unfounded. And based on all those reasons, you know, that they were just weren't believing the women and it wasn't going to go anywhere. And it just caused this huge change and now developed in what we call the Philadelphia model that we're trying to bring into Canada and that we are actually bringing into Canada in a number of different areas, where the police and community agencies, so sexual assault centers, come in and review files together to identify flaws in investigations, to identify where biases and stereotypes might have driven decisions. And they have reopened some cases. And importantly, they have come away with better relationships, like better respect for each other, because it's not a gotcha. It's how can we improve the police response? And so needless to say, the number of unfounded cases have gone down. The police are improving, like genuinely improving their response. Now, in Canada, after the big expose by the national newspaper showing that, you know, the rates were varied across the country and in some places very, very high, there was pressure from an activist that had already been growing in Ottawa, and so to implement the Philadelphia model. And she's had some success in some, but others just said, nope, no problem here. No, we had a look at our files and it's okay. We haven't done anything wrong. Others said, okay, we'll do an investigation internally. And others said, you know, let's do this model that's really going to help us to improve our response. So I don't know where that's at now. I know that there's a number of different communities that are working with this expert to now implement that model in a fulsome way. And I think that's the only way you can do it, is to actually honestly open it up. And the results aren't made public. It's not a research study. It's to improve processes and responses. So that's where my hope lies.
This may be an entirely inappropriate comparison, but it kind of reminds me of instant replay in sports. Where at first they were thinking, well, the umpires or referees are going to get mad because they're going to be shown up. But pretty quickly it's turned into, no, let's just get it right.
Yeah. I think that's what it is. You know, it's an instant replay. Okay, what went on here? Let's look at these files. And if you've got senior management behind it and you've got the sexual assault investigators behind it, it can result in a culture shift. And I've had my hopes up around these things before, but the Philadelphia experience, I think, demonstrated, and it's taken up in other countries or other cities now around the U.S. as well. It just started in Philadelphia, but it does show that it can affect material change, not just changing where you tick the box.
So we just have a few minutes left. I want to come back to some really basic things. One of them is that in these police statistic reports that I cited at the beginning, 0.1 rape per 100,000 in Egypt, et cetera, many of those countries don't define marital rape as rape. Mm-hmm. And I know that some of the backlash against, for example, the Me Too movement has been that, oh, these days, if you like just, I don't know, they'll make up these absurd examples about how, oh, for crying out loud, we have Allen Ginsberg, whom I can't stand. Allen Ginsberg had this line about how feminists make everything sexy sound like rape. That's a direct quote from Allen Ginsberg. Yeah. And so can we define I want you to define two things. One is, what is a metric for actual sexual assault? And the other is, what is a metric? If I'm going to talk about the relationship between sexual assault and status of women, I know this is probably outside your bailiwick, but how would we define status of women?
Yeah, well, the UN tries to do that, and they do have an index. It's things like employment, education, political representation, number of children, inversely, and a few other things, and they put them together into an index. So, you know, indices have their issues, and you always want to disaggregate them to see what's high and what's low. But, you know, that's one way to measure it. But it's the definitions of sexual violence vary. As you say, you know, some countries, marital rape is not there. We don't even have rape, which, you know, is a whole other 45-minute program about the negative consequences of that. But, you know, that's another problem with comparing countries using police statistics, is you're comparing on criminal code definitions, which are inconsistent. Whereas the face-to-face or the telephone surveys use the same questions, and they don't rely on having to adhere to criminal codes.
So my last question is, what sort of policy changes, if they made you the queen of stopping violence against women, what sort of policy changes would you enact in order to make some changes in stopping men's violence against women?
Well, all my work has been around the criminal justice system, and you know, I think it's so critical. I mean, I would open up the police to broader scrutiny, and in a positive way, like through the Philadelphia model kind of a way. But they're, you know, far too secretive and far too powerful. And, you know, they're making decisions that are critical for the lives of the people who come to them. And, you know, until they get their reputation improved, women aren't going to come forward. They're not going to get justice. And there's a whole lot of violent men out there who are just have impunity. So I think that, you know, I see incremental change, and I'm hopeful for that. But I think, you know, we have to clean up the criminal justice system. Then the court system, of course, is, you know, it's a really tough go for women. That's a whole other thing. But, you know, and then work on rape culture. Acknowledge it. You know, and we've been saying this for years too, which, you know, I don't sound very hopeful, and I'm not. You know, we have to start with kids, and we have to start in schools. And there's been a whole lot of work done there where, you know, there's very positive male groups in schools that are talking about toxic masculinity and doing all kinds of great work. And then you see these young guys coming out of high school and going into university and thinking it's free reign on women. You know, drug them and rape them. So, you know, I think we need to change all those things. I'm just not sure I know how.
So this is really unfair, but I'm gonna do it anyway. That I'm thinking about one of the problems with reporting with my mom back when she was being beaten and raped by my father was that when she would attempt to talk to the police about it, and this is a 50s, 60s. After the police left, even if the police were sensitive, which they often were not, she would get beaten far worse. Mm-hmm. So there's this problem of not only do we have the question of the police response, but if nothing happens, and we all know that if you expose what the perpetrator did to you, that can lead to negative consequences in your own life.
And that's why a lot of women don't report sexual violence. You know, we did some work locally with the Ottawa police. We have mandatory charging in the province of Ontario where I live. And we were interested to see whether women thought this was a good thing or not. And that was, you know, how do we improve the police response around that? And it was really mixed. A lot of women said, you know, I don't report because I'm afraid I'm going to get punished. Very, very legitimate concern. Or I called the police and they walked away. So then I got beaten, or, you know, I went to a shelter and then I had nowhere else to go and I had to go back home and then I got beaten. So, you know, I think things have improved since the 50s and 60s and there are more supports and shelters. But, you know, a lot of women don't want to go to the police for those reasons. And then they just are at home and very, very vulnerable and a terrible place to be.
Well, thank you for all that. And that's a terrible thing to end on. So can we end on something better?
Something, I don't know. We need something hopeful.
Yeah. So give me something good.
I am impressed and encouraged by the actions of some young men who call each other out or who are actively involved in peer groups and in NGOs and in work on the ground to change toxic masculinity. That's what gives me hope. Because, you know, women, just talking about patriarchy, so far has not changed the world radically. It has to be a more fulsome effort. And, you know, there are many young men who are just, you know, this is not good. This is not appropriate, guys, and that needs to happen.
Well, as it should, because I mean the problem of men's violence against women is not women's fault, it's men's fault, and men should fix it.
Yeah. And when I've had, and here's another negative note, but when I've had discussions with, you know, in gatherings about sexual violence, because people often ask me my opinion on things, and that, you know, when I get a decent man saying, well, not all men rape, I'll say, well, I didn't say all men rape. Like, it's a defense mechanism. Why are you blaming men? Well, it's men that are raping. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been so helpful. And I think that listeners are going to learn a lot from it too. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dr. Holly Johnson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.